sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The ISM manufacturing number cuts under 50. Markets up, snapping 2 weeks of losses. And worries abate as the jobs report, well, comes in kind of tepid. Our guest today, Carly Garner, author of the book High Probability Commodity Trading. All this and much more on episode number 474 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a happy Labor Day weekend to you. It's the start of September, and you know what that means? When September starts and the first week arrives of any month, we have the unemployment report that comes out. We'll talk about this and much more about that. This is Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining me on this weekend. Lots of football, lots of tennis, lots of sports that are on TV right now. Hopefully, you're having a wonderful Labor Day weekend, some barbecues, and all sorts of other great things. Now, you heard what I just said, by the way. I said, worries abate after a tepid jobs number. Well, what the heck does that mean? What worries? We have a tepid jobs number. Well, it wasn't really tepid. It was 151,000 were added, right? We saw that the unemployment rate stayed at 4.9%. The U6 rate remained at 9.7%. So what worries would abate if we have a tepid number? Right. Oh, yeah. Worries about a September rate hike. We see that now the chance of a rate hike in September has gone down to about 21%. And now we have this whole celebration by markets because, well, we saw that the ISM number was under 50, and that is a sign of contraction in the manufacturing area. First time we've seen that in a while. Not a really good sign. Not a good sign to see that we're back into contraction in manufacturing. We know that we saw a lot of the regional numbers over the last several months show some weakness, some of them coming back a little bit, but there's been this back and forth and rather volatile action in terms of the interim monthly numbers, which sometimes can be noisy. You want to look at them on a long-term basis, and you want to look at those on an average. So kind of maybe a three-month average, maybe a six-month average, what's happening with these numbers. But the concern about a rate hike is what really has been, and not just recently, for a while, driving markets. Yeah, just simply a quarter point. Amazing how a quarter point rate hike is jarring markets either direction. And while the ISM number coming in light did in fact cause a bit of a sell-off, nothing major, during the mid part of the day, there was a, earlier in the week, there was a small decline on that, and then towards the end of the day, we saw the buyers come in. And on this number, expectations were about 171 for the new jobs added, and only about 151 or so were added. There was some revisions to past numbers that actually helped and made things look a little bit better, and the average over the last several months is still over 200,000 new jobs added. So things are really kind of good, but this number somehow translated to traders as an algorithms and the high frequency traders as, hey, you know what? A September rate hike probably is off the table because it wasn't just a blowout number. The expectations, listen, what happened was the expectations were that if we saw like 275 or 300,000 print, that the Fed would be forced to actually do something, even though this is ahead of a presidential election that would be coming. But right now, the probability has pushed it off somehow into maybe December. There's a 55% chance, as a matter of fact, right now that is seen by Fed funds futures that the December meeting will actually have a rate hike. So we saw, you know, a variety of other things throughout the week. We saw that consumer confidence and in the form of spending was a lot better, or it was better, not really a lot better. It was better than expectations. And you know, overall, there was kind of, a mixed bag overall in economic numbers. But I still don't think that there is a focus on this from the aspect of, okay, well, markets are going to react normally, with quotes around that, normally, on economic numbers. Because again, the underside of this is that there are all sorts of crazy conditions that would have to be in place for a significant rise in interest rates, which would cause, obviously, a slowdown in corporate stock buybacks and corporate debt issuance, as well as the fact that, obviously, there would be a change to the paradigm, potentially, from the Fed and what would happen with regard to bond purchases, etc. Not to mention the cost of carrying and reissuing bonds from the government. So the whole paradigm right now is, well, as long as we have moderate to tepid growth overall from a GDP standpoint and from other indicators, well, things are just status quo. And that's good. We saw that pending home sales increased 1.3% in July. And we did see also that new home sales were really good, but existing home sales were a bit weak overall. We saw also the Case-Shiller 20-city home price index increased 5.1% on a year-over-year basis. That's starting to slow down a little bit, but still 5% increase on a year-over-year basis is pretty good. Now, coming up, we know that on Monday, it's Labor Day, so therefore, U.S. markets are closed. We're going to see the service index from ISM. Well, this is the other side of the manufacturing, two components, the manufacturing and the service index. Service index would probably be about 70% of what we do here in the U.S., a much more important number. That's coming out Tuesday. And we're going to see earnings from a few players like Casey's General and Dave & Buster's, TiVo. Wednesday, we're going to see an announcement by Apple. This is the 7th, with their tagline for their meeting, "See you on the 7th," which some people think means something about the iPhone 7 that will be coming out, and we'll see what's going to be happening with that, what they're going to be announcing, and if they're going to have something that is very significant to cause people to upgrade to this latest edition of the iPhone, which would be kind of good. We're going to have the Beige Book coming out this week as well, and a few other things, really just key numbers from the Labor Department on jobs on Thursday, and some other earnings like on Friday, Kroger and Hovnanian, which is a home builder, high-end home builder, which is not done very well. But overall, the week is kind of light when it comes to economic numbers and earnings numbers. So markets are kind of going to be on their own with regard to what's happening here in the U.S., maybe some key clues what's happening in the world from some other places, and of course, a probable announcement of some kind of concerted, coordinated, and agreed-upon stimulus, growth, some initiative by the G20, which is just standard. I mean, there's nothing at all that really we should take away from that as being, oh yeah, that's something new. They talk about the same thing every time. They're going to have something that they're going to do, and they're going to be committed to global growth. Of course, they're going to come out, I'm certain, we're going to see something about a agreement between a variety of the countries that they are not going to be involved in any kind of competitive currency devaluations. You know, because they say this on the surface, right? Well, no. We agree. No. Of course. We're not going to get involved in any kind of currency devaluations that are going to, you know, be a race to the bottom. And we don't want to see that. We want to keep our currency strong, which is kind of funny because right after that, they'll throw that whole thing away and go back to their current, you know, currency devaluation process, or at least their attempt to keep it weak. Because we're not going to call what we're doing in here in the United States or anywhere else around the world, like negative interest rates, an attempt to keep our currency down, because that would be a bad thing. That's not competitively fair. You do that, and man, your prices are going to be cheaper for your products. And what are they? Well, we're going to have to do the same thing. And then we get into this competition between the two of us. You know, it's kind of like two gas stations on the corner that are across from each other, dropping their prices and getting into a pricing war. Well, who does that benefit? Well, it benefits us short term, but nobody's going to win because we just have to keep on getting lower and lower and lower. So you know what? Let's move our price a little bit lower and keep them the same as each other. And then, you know, maybe we'll get more business than the guy two blocks away. That's an under the table agreement, of course. Outwardly, in the currency environment, governments say, well, you know what? We're not going to do this. Of course not. And everybody should know we're not going to be getting involved in currency devaluations, especially when it involves multiple countries and causes unfair trade practices. Wink, wink. So anyway, that's the bottom line of that. Just realize when you see these things come out, it's kind of a joke. And the G20 has been relatively a joke as well because they're just making nice with each other. And I think it's really more of a feel-out session with what each other is going to possibly do and then how that each country individually can effectively find a way and a loophole to get underneath the process and be more competitive. So as long as nobody shows their cards too transparently, the G20 is just a matter of blather. Moving right along. And our guest today is someone who knows a lot about commodities, an area that we don't really talk about that often on the show. Last week, we talked about options. So I thought we'd have an expert, Carly Garner, author of the book, High Probability Commodity Trading. We'll put all the information, of course, on where you can find out about the book and the things that she does on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Carly, well, hello. How are you?
Thanks, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about commodities, and I got to tell you, there's been a lot of movement. We see that, of course, there's commodities in equity futures and things of that nature. There's foodstuffs, there's metals, there's oil. Let's talk about what a commodity is to begin with. Why don't you kind of explain it to the audience?
Okay. Well, like you said, when most people think of commodities, they think of corn and wheat and crude oil. But commodities is a pretty ambiguous term. It actually encompasses a lot of things. Basically, a commodity is interchangeable with the word futures contract, which is traded on most of them in the United States are traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And essentially, it could be a stock index. It can be a treasury. It can be currencies, gold, silver, crude oil. There's even futures contracts on the meats, so like live cattle, lean hogs, those sorts of things.
Pork bellies.
Pork bellies, believe it or not, were delisted from the exchange.
Thank God.
Yeah, it was one of those things that everyone. That was the first because that was really the first thing anyone ever mentioned to me. Hey, so I could trade pork bellies. Well, really, for some odd reason, I think it's because they watched, you know, the movie Trading Places, and that mm-hmm. was, you know, that's where they got it. But pork bellies was one of those things that everybody talked about, but nobody traded. And right. So they actually delisted it because it didn't have enough trading volume. But the idea is a futures contract is basically an agreement to buy or sell the underlying commodity at a specific price at a specific point in the future. And that's kind of seems a little more confusing than it really is. It really, the bottom line is, people are exchanging contracts or liabilities. Like, for example, it's easier just to talk about examples. Right now, corn is trading at roughly, we'll just round it to $4 a bushel. If somebody thinks, $3 a bushel. If somebody thinks corn's going to be at $4 a bushel in December, they'd simply buy a corn futures contract and hope that in December the market's trading at a higher price. If it's not, they're liable for the losses sustained on because the price dropped. If the price goes up, then they make money accordingly. But the simple answer, I guess, is what is a commodity? It is any interchangeable good that can be traded on a futures exchange.
So what's interesting is the difference between, and this doesn't happen all that much, although there are those that trade commodities because they actually want possibly to hedge out a particular product. Let's just talk about corn. And so what they do is they maybe say, well, we have this amazing, they're a farmer and they have this amazing crop and they want to make sure they get their price. So they may do something with the actual futures and commodities contract to hedge out their actual price of their corn. But, you know, sometimes the difference is with a stock, when you own a stock and or an option, you know, when you make it delivery of the shares, right, at the end of the thing, the difference is it's a paper delivery. So when you buy right. something and you have, you know, you may get 100 shares at a certain price and they may put it to you, whatever. It can be put to you also in the area of commodity. You could theoretically have to take possession of, you know, 1,000 bushels of corn, right?
In theory, yes. So I like to explain it like this. Like when you're buying a stock, you're buying an asset. You pretty much own the future cash flows of that security. When you're buying a commodity, you're really buying a liability. You are taking responsibility for the future cash flow, and that future cash flow is not dividends or interest or anything like that. It is the cash flow that occurs when you exit the commodity. So if you buy it today and you sell it next week, if you made money, then money comes your way. The exchange gives you what you made on that contract. But if you lose money, then you owe the exchange the money that you lost. Mm-hmm. So it's when you're buying a commodity, it's more of a liability. You hear horror stories of people saying, you know, I don't want to trade commodities because I don't want to take delivery of 5,000 bushels of corn. I can honestly tell you, I've been a broker for about 12 years, and I've never had a client take delivery of any commodity. 99.9% of futures contracts are offset before it gets to that point. So don't ever think that you're going to accidentally or unknowingly take delivery of the commodity.
A truckload of meat that shows up one day. Hello. Hey, look
exactly.
at that. Oh, I own a orange juice plant now, you know, something like that, whatever.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about how you deal with this. Because now let's also mention that commodities are like options, have a date, have an expiration date, right?
They do. They expire. Every commodity is a little bit different. So, for example, like crude oil expires every month. The grains expire like three or four times a month, depending on which contract you're looking at. But yeah, they expire. So it's not as easy like in stock land. You just buy, you know, whatever shares of stock you're buying and you can hold on to it for 5 or 10 years, whatever your investment horizon is. In commodities, everything is done on a much shorter term because the contracts expire. So, and if you try to go out further, let's say you wanted to hold crude oil for 2 or 3 years, in theory, you could go out and find a contract that expires 3 years from now. But the problem with that is there's no market for it. It's not liquid. There's nobody else trading. So you really don't want to do that. So what traders do is they'll trade the front month contract and then they have to do what's called rolling it over to avoid deliveries. So for example, if they're long October crude oil that expires in 3 weeks from now, when the expiration date comes close, they'll sell their October contract and they'll buy in November. So it is a little more hands-on than stock trading, that's for sure, for anybody that's wanting to hold.
And one of the things is that when that roll happens, and you could do it right up to the date, but there's certain dates that probably a little bit more advantageous beforehand to get into it because, you know, as the thing expires, it gets less liquid, et cetera. But one of the things that we know is that when you roll, you don't know if the next month is going to be exactly the same. It's not going to be exactly the same price. It's not like you just roll into it. So what happens is that the next month, so you have the current month, and then you have the next month, and the next month after that, there may be a discount or a premium. Now, these are two big words that people always talk about in the area of commodities. So it's backwardation and contango. Go through that.
Right, exactly. So contango is the most normal scenario in a commodity market. And it's basically the idea that a commodity that's eligible for delivery today is going to be cheaper than one that's eligible for delivery a month from now. And the difference being, in that 30 days time or whatever it is, the commodity has to be stored and they have to buy insurance on it and it has to be maintained. And so there are costs associated with that. So in a normal market condition, the next contract month is going to be trading higher than the current contract month. So every time you roll over, and it's not, you know, it doesn't always happen this way, but more often than not it does. Every time you roll over, you're probably going to be selling the contract that's expiring for a cheaper price than you're buying the next month. So there definitely is some a little bit of a disadvantage in that aspect of it, for sure.
Yeah, and then the exact opposite is with backwardation.
Right. With backwardation, sometimes if there's a supply shortage or something that, causes the inventory in the short term to be squeezed, you'll see prices on the front month actually trade higher than prices on the back month commodity. And that's called backwardization. It's relatively rare, but it does happen. So just something to keep an eye on.
So let's talk a little bit about seasonality and things. I mean, a lot of people, they think, well, all right, I'll trade commodities. All right, now, here we are. Let's kind of pick a date. This is an easy one. It is, let's think what the date would be. April, May. They're like, you know, I have an idea. I'm going to buy oil because in the summertime, oil prices are higher because a lot more usage. You got boats, you got traveling, you got vacations, you got campers, you got all this stuff going on in the summertime. And boy, that seems like an easy play.
It's true. Actually, the two best seasonal trades in the energy market are with crude oil. One, which is coming up soon, is actually crude oil normally peaks in October and generally trades weaker. Now, one thing to disclose before I go any further is seasonals work more often than they don't, but they're by no means guaranteed.
Right. Well,
some years they work, some years they don't, some years they're early, some years they're late. But it's a great tool, and we're big fans of taking different types of market analysis, whether, you know, fundamental, technical, and seasonal, and kind of putting it all together and coming up with a plan. So crude oil does normally peak in October. It generally, you mentioned that, you know, buying in May might be a good idea because of the summer driving season, and you're absolutely on point with the summer driving season and the increased demand. But believe it or not, the seasonal up move actually occurs a little bit early. It starts in like January or February, and then it actually peaks out in May. And the reason being is, you know, when we fill our cars up, we're filling it up with processed gasoline, not crude oil. And so the demand for crude oil actually comes earlier because that's when the refineries are stockpiling and getting ready to refine it to produce gasoline for us to use in our cars during the summer driving season.
And not to mention, you know, also, obviously, one of the other reasons it is earlier is because everybody knows the season now, the seasonality, and they want to get in ahead of everybody else, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's no secrets here. The markets are all knowing.
Right.
You know, we're all reading the same things, and we all have the same ideas.
Right. So if I'm a new investor to the commodity markets, let's also mention one other thing. Let's talk about this. I think it's very important because it's extremely important when it comes to commodities. When you buy a stock and you buy $5,000 worth of a stock, you own $5,000 worth of the stock, right? You follow what I'm saying?
Yep, okay. Absolutely.
And it goes up or down, it goes up or down, you know, it goes up a point, whatever. When you buy $5,000 of a commodity, let's say one contract of, let's just make this up, okay, one contract, let's say on oil, one contract of oil is $5,000, let's just say. You can't buy a half a contract, first of all, okay? So it's $5,000. What do you really own?
Okay, that's a good question. All right. So there's a few things here. There is, just as an FYI, there actually is a mini crude contract that's available now that is half the size of the original. But we'll go off the original, which is the most common. So the original crude oil contract is, right now crude's trading at, we'll just round it to $45 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So the margin on that trade is about $4,000. We'll go to your five just to keep it simple. So let's say the margin is $5,000. So if you had $5,000 in your account, in theory, you could buy one crude oil future with crude trading at $45 a barrel. That means you're actually making or losing money based on $45,000 worth of crude oil. So your $5,000 is essentially buying $45,000 worth of exposure in the crude oil market. Obviously, this can go extremely right, but it can go extremely, extremely wrong too. The leverage is a lot for many traders to handle, which is why I usually recommend, in fact, I always recommend, traders should never trade on the minimum margin. They should always overfund their account. So you could actually overfund your account to a point where you completely eliminate the leverage in commodities. So if you put $45,000 in a commodity account and you only bought one crude oil future, you completely eliminated the leverage. So you don't have to use the leverage that the market gives you.
Right, but let's also, so now let's take this further. So now you have a $5,000 contract, oil's trading at 45. Let's just, again, go through the same numbers. But you're really, you know, 10 times that. So what happens is that if you have a 10% move lower on oil, you could wipe out your entire $5,000 position.
Right. So exactly. So a 10% move in oil would be like $4.50. And trust me, crude can do that in one day. I've seen it many, many times. So if you happen to be long on that day, let's say crude went up $4.50, you made $4,500. You almost doubled your account. But if you were long and crude went down $4.50 in a $5,000 account, you would have almost wiped out your account in a single day. So let's take this one step further.
Sure. It doesn't go down $5. It goes down $10.
Okay.
Now what happens?
I got a
$5,000 account. I got a $5,000, besides a margin call, of course. I got a $5,000 account. It moved away from me. Technically, now I'm in the hole for, I lost my $5,000. I'm in the hole for $5,000.
That's true. Now, it depends on the brokerage firm you're using and the arrangement you have with them. I would say nowadays, like 10 years ago, things were a lot different. Before, like when everything was open outcry, not everybody had electronic trading access to their accounts. Honestly, 10 years ago, you probably could have said that most likely you would have been $4,000 or $5,000 in the hole, meaning you lost more than you had on deposit. In today's world, it's very rare, unless you have a special relationship with your broker, that your broker would let you do that. And the reason they don't let you do it anymore isn't necessarily because they're nicer, or they were nicer then. It's just because now that everything's electronic, your broker can see exactly how much money is in your account. And if you get to a point where you're about to lose more than what's on deposit, they try to liquidate you. But there's no guarantee. Sometimes
it could gap. It could, for sure.
I mean, like the flash crash in 2011 or something extreme like that, it is very possible that you lose more money than you have on deposit.
Right.
And in that case, you'd have to write your broker a check to make your account whole. And that's hard to do. That's a sad day.
Yeah. Then that's what happened, by the way, with currency trading. When we saw, for example, a lot of off-sided trades in, I believe it was the Swissy, when they delinked, and all of a sudden, they delinked, and it was like, huh, what? And it was like a 30% move because everybody was covering and doing whatever. And the firm that was FX, what was the name of the firm?
FXCM, I think.
FXCM, right. FXCM was, I think they got bombed by about $430 million because, frankly, I guess what happened is all these accounts blew up and they couldn't collect.
Correct, right. So, now, that was a horrific day. Now, we're a brokerage firm ourselves, and we have clients that trade all commodities. We were super lucky on that day. We only had a couple clients that were trading the Swiss franc, and luckily they were trading option spreads that had limited risk. So although they lost a little money, it wasn't devastating to them nor to us. But I do know some commodity brokers that, quite frankly, that move put them out of business because, like you said, like on the futures side of things, somebody could have easily, and this is a rare scenario. This doesn't happen often. I've only seen this once in my career, but it happened. But a futures trader could have easily, if they didn't have a stop loss order or anything protecting them, and they had a future out there, could have easily lost $20,000 to $30,000 in the blink of an eye. And you can imagine, not many people would want to write their broker a check for that type of situation. So it could easily, if we would have had a couple of those, probably would have put us out of business as well. Luckily, we did.
Well, this is really a topic for another show. But one of the things I didn't understand about FXCM, the way that the traders were actually positioned there was they're using the Swissy as a alternative for the euro, and I think they were short the Swissy, long the euro, or something really weird. And it's like, it was supposedly. I was like, why? The trade didn't make any sense. Like, in other words, there was no benefit to the whole trade, and then it just blew up in their faces.
Well, one weird thing about the FXCM is Forex, not futures.
Correct.
It's a little different.
Yep.
It's like futures, like somebody trading currency futures with us, their trades are executed on a centralized exchange, the CME, and the CME actually guarantees the other side of the trade. So even if the client doesn't pay, they're going to make the broker pay or someone else. So those trades are really guaranteed on the futures exchange. In Forex, it's a little different. There is third-party risk, and that's kind of what happened with FXCM. Like the people on the other side of their trades that, they had some clients making money and some clients losing money. Well, the people losing money weren't going to pay up, and the people that
made money
wanted their money, and there was no money to be had.
Right.
And so a firm like FXCM is actually, they were acting as the broker. They basically take the other side of their client's trade.
Right.
And so, and then they try to hedge themselves in an interbank market. So it got really hairy, and just when it blew up, it blew up in everybody's faces, and there wasn't enough money to go around. So
right, let's get back to commodities for a second here. What is tell me your favorite commodities for people to trade.
Well, I'll start with, like, if you've never traded commodities before and you're a beginner, I think the best way to go about it is to go really small, because not everybody is accustomed to the leverage and the way that commodities move. Commodities are different than stocks. They don't just go up over time like clockwork. And I mean, obviously the stock market has volatility, but you can't deny it almost always goes up in the long run. Mm-hmm. Commodities don't do that. They trade sideways. They generally trade in a range. I mean, even crude oil, that sees it's a really big range, but it still trades in a range. I mean,
we'll call it 40 to 50. I mean, that's pretty much the range.
Well, recently, yes. But if you look back, you know, since like 2007, we got up to $150 a barrel. Then we dropped to about $30. Then we went back up to $115, and then we dropped back down to the 20s. So, I mean, it's a huge range, but it's a really big range. So it's just a little bit different than stock trading. So what I recommend is use the really small contracts. So there's mini corn and there's a mini wheat, where traders only make or lose $10 per penny. So something like that, it's almost like paper trading with some skin in the game, so you get the whole experience. And then there's also some e-micro currency futures, which are also small. You only make or lose $1 per tick. So, I mean, that way you can kind of do some buy and hold sort of trades. You can scale in and scale out. You don't have to have a huge account. You're not risking a lot of money, but you get, you know, get the feel for things.
The E-mini on the S&P, though, is what? What's the current minimum contract?
Okay, the E-mini on the S&P, it's a little misleading because they call it a mini, but
it's not.
Can
it's, like,
move.
It's like a heck. Yeah, exactly.
It can move fast.
It's 50, it's 50 bucks per tick.
It is. It's 50 bucks a point. Now, in their defense, the original futures contract for the S&P was $250 a tick. Actually, if you go way back, I think it was $500. And then they moved it to $250 bucks a point in the S&P on the full-size contract, and that contract still trades. So the E-mini is one-fifth the size of that, so I guess it is mini relative to the big one, but it still can move really quickly. So if you're looking to trade stock indices, I kind of like the NASDAQ. It moves a little slower. It's $20 a point, you know, for beginning traders, but definitely you can't underestimate the leverage there.
Yeah, the problem is that moves a lot more than the S&P, so it's almost an equal contract, as I've always found. In terms of, you know, S&P moves 1 point, the NASDAQ can move 2 points.
It can. Yeah, you know? It just kind of depends on the environment, but yeah, it can.
So what about some of these commodity ETFs?
Okay.
I've always said that, you know, there are good ones and there are bad ones and there are horrific ones.
Right.
You know, one of the things that's happening, I don't know if you read this interesting story recently. This deals with commodities and the VIX. So you have people probably trading, you know, I'm assuming because you do options and all that, you do, you know, the VIX, they're buying, buying volatility. Now, what is the story with the VIX, right? It just can't go up. And if it does go up, it doesn't stay up. And it doesn't matter what's going on. And the VIX has like been sub for, you know, long-term averages forever. And we know volatility is tight. We know that, you know, markets, there's a lot of buyers these days after whatever particularly happened after the post-Brexit vote. I'm not exactly sure what happened. Maybe people think, hey, the end of the world. Well, it didn't happen, so we'll buy. But one of the things I recently read was a story about why the VIX can't be maintained at a higher level. And one of the reasons is that all these VIX-linked ETFs keep on buying it as much as possible because they keep having to roll it, and there's a lot of money going into these various ETFs. And the creators of the, you know, the sellers, if you will, right? The sellers are just all too happy to be doing this all day long. They just and they're just creating tons of this stuff. And the VIX, therefore, it's just not going anywhere.
Right. Huh. That's interesting. I haven't read anything about that, but it doesn't surprise me. I can tell you when the commodity ETFs first started coming around, maybe a decade ago or so, they really did mess up the commodity markets. And I mean, big time. like we saw wheat go to 13 bucks. I mean, there were other factors involved. It wasn't just that, but it changed the nature of the commodity markets, because all of a sudden you had the average investor trying to put money into corn and wheat and other alternative assets. And so it really ballooned the prices of a lot of commodities.
And by the way,
artificially.
Just to let you know, I am totally against commodity ETFs that affect my pocketbook. Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
I agree
you have a commodity ETF, let's say, for example, they were talking about an aluminum one, right? I'm thinking, oh, God, the aluminum guys are going to be thrilled with this whole thing, right? They're going to be happy as clams because now you have everybody that can put in $50 at a clip and hold it forever into an aluminum ETF. Or, you know, for example, there's DBA and DBC, which are commodity-based ETFs. Mm-hmm. And these buy foods. Now, wait a minute. I don't want the average guy boosting my food prices up.
Exactly.
That's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life.
Right. Me personally, I'm not a big fan of commodity ETFs, not as an ideal and not as an investment. For one, they're inefficient. And for two, like you mentioned, it can affect prices, at least in the short term, maybe not in the long term. But it seems to exacerbate the highs and the lows. And so I'm not a fan myself.
All right. Let's talk about some of the things that are happening in current market conditions here. Any thoughts, let's say, on... directionality of what's happening with the S&P, or maybe you want to talk about gold and silver, the relationship with gold and silver. Where do you want to start with that?
Okay, well, I can talk about both of those. Then my thoughts on the S&P, honestly, I don't have anything too exciting. I've never seen a market this quiet ever. I mean, it's really kind of eerie. And my thought is, as much as I'd love to see it continue higher on this path, For the sake of my 401k, I really feel like we're due for a pretty big correction. So me personally, and I'm not a portfolio advisor or anything like that. I'm a commodity broker, so don't listen to me. But I'm cautious. Let's just put it that way. I'm extremely cautious.
How about this? Why is it so quiet? I'll give you a couple of answers, in my opinion, at least. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Number one. First of all, there is complacency. I don't mean complacency that, you know, oh, complacency, that means a train wreck is about to happen. Complacency because, you know, there's this buying the dip thing that's coming from God knows where. Okay. Is it coming from institutional investors? No, maybe. Is it coming from share buybacks? Absolutely. Is it coming from sovereign wealth funds that we know are now starting to buy stocks in various markets? Yeah, probably. You know, unlimited money, you could buy whatever you want. Then you have the fact that there's, kind of less liquidity out there, which, you know, that's why you see these spikes, but then it just comes right back up. It's just kind of that. I think you also have this whole index fund mentality, all this money going into index funds, where the thought is, you know, we as traders, as investors, long-term and short-term, have very short memories, right? So, you know, what correction happened a year ago, 5 years ago? All right, everything came back. So what we'll do is that, you know, why are we bothering with this, all this shenanigans, right? Trading and all. Just put it in an S&P 500 ETF and just let it sit no matter what happens. Therefore, as we see these shallow corrections, or whatever you want to call them, dips. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I say shallow, I mean shallow, okay?
Right.
What happens is that nobody's doing anything. Nobody's trading. That's why volumes are so low. So you have the combination of index fund investing, where everybody is now in this mindset that just let it sit forever and make 7% a year on average for the S&P 500, for the Dow and all that. Just who cares? Nobody does anything, right? Nobody gets spooked too much. And then you have the central banks that are well managing the fact that we have low interest rates, which creates liquidity, which every single time there's a bit of a dip, it's bought. I don't think it's natural. I don't think it's good. I don't mean to say that we need to have hysterical volatility in the markets. You know, sometimes it's fun, but you know what I'm saying? Long term, that's not good. But yet I think there's this terrible new mindset that there is that there's no risk in the markets, and therefore I'll just rebalance. If something goes down a little bit, I'll take the money that went up and put it down there, and I'll just rebalance the portfolio continually. And these automatic rebalancing programs aren't helping the situation either. Keeping everything afloat.
I agree.
So anyway, that's my more than 2 cents on that. And so anyway, let's talk a little bit about some of the moves in coffee lately. So we see that coffee, I guess due to maybe some Brazilian issues there, and maybe due to some weather issues. I mean, do you have like a whole weather forecasting thing in your office?
I personally don't. We tend to, I mean, some commodity traders, that's all they do is watch weather and those sorts of things. We tend to just kind of focus more on the technical analysis side of things, the seasonals. We look at the COT report, which is basically the CFTC's weekly I don't know how to explain it, but it's basically
it's the
like
report
a,
who hold, it's a report who holds the commodity, who's short, who's long, basically.
Exactly, right. It's going to tell you who's long, who's short, where they're putting their money where their mouth is. So,
but what do you pay attention to on that report? Because there's three different sources of information on each of those reports. Now, each report covers, for example, the COT, a commitment of traders report for, let's say, corn, commitment of traders report for oil. There's three different ones. There's retail, there's institutional, and then there's hedgers, right?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I mean, some people call them slightly different, but right. Yeah, they're basically that's the same idea. What we look for is when we look at the COT, we're looking for overheated markets. So we want to know if, like the large speculators, basically the guys that have deep money and are holding big positions, we want to know if their position has grown to be too large. Because the thing is, if the guys, the big players in the market, are already long a market, then who else is left to buy? You know, usually when they get to that point, the buying dries up. In the case of crude oil, to be categorized as a large speculator, you have to be somebody that's trading or holding at least 350,000 contracts. Sorry, 350 contracts, which most of us don't have that kind of loot. Yeah. So margin-wise, I think it comes out to about $1,200, $1.2 million in margin, and leverage-wise, it's probably like 100 and something million in the commodity. So most of us just are not trading that kind of size. But the thing that's nice, like I mentioned, is if they start getting, like, for example, in crude oil, when they start holding anywhere from 250,000 to 300,000 in net long positions, is usually when crude kind of the buying dries up and the rally starts to fade. So we look for those sorts of things.
You know what I like to see on the commitment traders of traders report? I like to see epic short positions. Now, I could go both ways, short or long, but I like to see epically large short positions because when you have an epically large long position, they're committed to the fact that they think longer term it's going up and they kind of can be, it's a different mentality. You follow what I'm saying here? It's like, when you have an epically large short position, you could bet your bottom dollar that they can get spooked and start covering and start a short covering rallies are always a lot more intense than a long sell-off, if you follow what I mean, right?
Right, exactly.
So I like to look at those kinds of situations. I view it like this. It's kind of like when everybody's on one side of the boat, the boat's probably not going to stay very stable. It's going to flip over. So always look for where that disproportional amount, and again, like I like to look at the short side, but, you know, disproportionate amount of growth, and especially when you see that, for example, the short positions on the commitment of traders report are growing. And growing slowly, growing, and then all of a sudden they all of a sudden hit, you know, and you see like all three are all of a sudden really, and they are sometimes called smart money, dumb money too. But you know when they really spike into a short area, like you know, that's going to be possibly weak hands that are going to be able to be ringed out pretty well.
Right. No, I agree with you 100%. And the funny thing about that is a lot of times people will. Like those big short squeezes can be epic. It happened a couple years ago in natural gas. Like everybody and their dog was short natural gas. Everyone on TV was this is natural gas at the time was at like $2. And everyone you talk to thinks natural gas is going to zero because there's a supply glut and gas companies are flaring and all this crazy stuff. But it didn't matter that fundamentals didn't change. It didn't matter there's still a supply glut. Natural gas went from like $2 to $6.50 in a couple weeks. So, I mean, you can see some really crazy things just on the, you know, as people are reversing positions and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So fundamentals don't matter. When it comes to the COT report, nobody cares about fundamentals.
Right. Let's talk two more things. Number one, explain what a managed futures program is.
Okay. Well, managed futures programs are—it's kind of a loose term. It can mean a lot of things, but formally, it's basically when you invest your money with a commodity trading advisor, a CTA, and the idea is the commodity trading advisor will, similar to a mutual fund, you put money in, and the trading advisor will trade your portfolio based on his method or ideas and so on and so forth. So, other than deciding when to put money in and take money out, you really don't have a lot of say of what's going on in the account. It's a little different than mutual funds in that each account is traded separately. So, like if I open an account at a certain broker for a certain CTA to trade, that account stays in my name. It's not mingled with other clients' funds or the broker's funds or anything like that. So it's an individually traded account. The thing about that you want to keep in mind about CTAs is the requirement to become a CTA. Let's just say this: the bar is not very high.
Yeah,
you
no
basically
kidding.
You take it to a proficiency exam, which really has nothing to do with trading. It's more of just compliance situation, you know, compliance rules and things like that. And then you pay the NFA, the National Futures Association, your membership fee, which I don't know. I think it's like $800, right, or somewhere in there. But other than that, those are your requirements. And then you jump right in and you can start managing for people. So you want to be really careful.
The difference is that a hedge fund, which could be a commodity-based hedge fund, is they'll commingle your money. The problem with CTAs, though, I would think, they can never – so I never knew this. A CTA can never commingle funds?
No. Now, there's a commodity pool advisor, CPO, which can – but you'll notice if you probably don't follow, but I follow like the CFTC and the NFA. They send out notifications of frauds that are going on. And I don't want to say that CPOs are fraudulent because they're not. There's a lot of
they're more susceptible.
But they're more, yes, that's the way what I want to try to say.
Right, because of commingling of funds. Of commingling of funds, that means that the advisor has to send out statements and do the accounting and all that.
Right. Yep, exactly.
But the problem with the CTA is how many portfolios can the CTA actually manage at once? That could get very complex.
It can, but you'd be surprised because they're mostly, really all clients are pretty much doing the same trades. Right. So what they'll do is they'll do block tickets, like depends on the CTA, but most of their accounts are probably with the same SCM or the same broker. So they can actually, most platforms or some of them are even old school and they call down to the floor still, but basically they're entering in one order. Let's say they have 100 clients. They'll place one order with 100 lots and then allocate it to each account. So it's not quite as difficult as it seems, but it definitely can get hairy if you've got a big book, for sure.
Mm, I gotcha. All right. I was going to talk about the dollar, but you know what? I don't want to talk about the dollar. I, to be honest with you, the dollar's boring. I mean, it's, you know, the whole currency market is,
yeah.
You know, by the way, in my opinion, you have to be severely... I want to be nice. Fill in the blank to be trading currencies these days with central banks on the other side of the trade. I mean, you're basically trading against a central bank.
Yeah.
I have no desire to do that.
Yeah. And like we saw with the Swiss franc, crazy things can happen.
Yeah. That's not a good idea. That's not my thing.
I can understand that.
You know, I want to play with somebody at least that's on my level. I'm not, you know, if I'm playing basketball, I'm not going into, you know, I'm not going to play with NBA guys. It's just not going to work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I my preference is I'm going to play against small people.
Makes sense.
Very small people, by the way. Okay. Anyway, Carly Garner wrote the book High Probability Commodity Trading. Also, you can find her at higherprobabilitycommoditytradingbook.com. A very nice, succinct, short URL, by the way.
Right.
You couldn't get anything shorter, huh?
Nope, that was it.
That was the best we could do.
That was
the best you could do.
Yeah.
Okay.
It works.
I guess.
It works well on Google.
Yeah, I suppose, because it's all spelled out. Anyway, thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to put all the information on the show notes for The Disciplined Investor, and people can get information from you on commodities. And if anybody's interested, of course, there's lots of good training out there and information for beginners, et cetera. And I think we both agree it's not something that you should jump into and just say, oh, I did a couple of paper trades and I did really well, because that's not the same as real trading. And, you know, this is a pretty levered type of play, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You want to make sure you do your homework before you put your money on the line, for sure.
I got you. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was good. I thought that was interesting. You can find out all the information, as I mentioned before, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Under the show notes for episode number 474, we have links to find out more about Carly, what she does, her book, all that stuff. I think it's kind of worthwhile to check out, especially if you have any interest at all in educating yourself or getting involved in the area of commodities and futures, etc. So check that out and see what's available. And of course, you can, as I mentioned, I think last week we have this really nice new feature on thedisciplinedinvestor.com where you can search by guest for any podcast or maybe a symbol or a topic. And what happens is that you can easily figure out what show they've been on, what they've been talking about. And if you want to listen to somebody like Frank Curzio, you can see all the shows that he's been on, the date, et cetera, and play it right there. It makes it very easy to search for some of your favorite people or to listen to something that you may have missed. So you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top bar, there's a little thing that says, I think, podcast search. And we'll give you a real good way of filtering, screening, scanning for information that you may be interested in checking out. Of course, you can follow me over on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, one word. And I want to remind you that each and every week we have a great podcast. John C. Dvorak, myself, on DH Unplugged is a podcast where we release on Tuesdays and we talk about some of the lighter side of business as well as some of the more serious things, and get underneath the headlines into what we think and kind of dissect some of the real meanings of what's going on in the business, in the world of business, as well as investing. We have a weekly stock picks competition, he and I. We also have a competition each week or so with the listeners. So if you think that you can actually get the price of a stock at a certain date that we post correct, well, you could be the winner of some nice prizes, like we have some great DH Unplugged t-shirts and et cetera. So I think it's a pretty entertaining show. I think you'll enjoy it over on dhunplugged.com. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up. I'm going to watch some football, some of the tennis that's on, some great games. Man, this has been some great matches in tennis at the U.S. Open. I'm going to go do that. Hopefully, you're going to have a great weekend, some great barbecue yourself. Thanks for joining me, Andrew Horowitz, here over and out for Labor Day weekend. We'll see you on the other side.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.